Not a year alcoholic, and thanks for coming back. So Tarek and I was talking, maybe we'll share our surrender process, like what happened, like when did I realize I needed help. So 6 months prior to entering the fellowship, I had visited a counselor, and my wife obviously forced me to go there. And she certified me as a borderline alcoholic. I said, screw you, you know, I'm not borderline. And I kept doing what I was going to do. And it was one afternoon I could see, I was looking out of the window. I said, geez, all lights were gone. You know, I realized that I had to change. So I said, like, God, please help me. You know, that prayer took me to a another group counseling, and then that led me to a psychiatrist, and he heard my story, and he said, like, you got to go to AA. You know, I told him that my brother had died of alcoholism also. He drank over an abuse, and he said he's not going to prescribe any medication for me. I needed a spiritual help solution. And I walked into the rooms of AA, and after 4 months of struggle, I ran into my mentor's talk on the internet. And that's why I'm a big proponent of giving away CDs. And most of the people I work with, I kind of point them to these workshops. I would point them to these segments in the workshop. I'll say, listen to this and get back to me. And that's how I kind of, you know, work with people. But I would sit with them for a couple of hours to kind of, you know, relay this idea of the peculiar mental twist. And we don't have any power to stay away from that first drink without the spiritual awakening. So that's my first step experience. Tarek?
Got to tell a background story on how I know Nari. I got sober in Joe and Charlie type big book studies. I felt like I was shot out of a cannon, made a lot of amends, but didn't make all of them. Did nothing with meditation, sponsored a lot of guys, but nothing about my character really changed other than my willingness to do whatever I had to do not to smoke crack. And around 9 months, I'm at the Alpharetta room, and this gentleman here is handing out CDs one night, and he hands me these two CDs. And I do like any good alcoholic or addict does. I go to my car and I just stick them in the car door. So let's fast forward 9 months later. 9 months later, I'm starting to really experience my bottom with the second half of the first step, which was unmanageability. For years, I thought the physical craving made me powerless and the mental obsession made my life unmanageable, because when I had a mental obsession, I couldn't pay my bills, I couldn't be in relationships, I couldn't keep jobs, etc., etc. Well, I'm somewhere between 16 and 18 months clean and sober, and I've got no mental obsession, but I've got all the bedevilments, all. I can't stand to be by myself. I'm constantly trying to call you guys in the fellowship to see what you're doing. I don't enjoy solitude. My money's upside down. I'm manipulating my family. There's just a lot of stuff going on in my life that I had a problem with that was becoming objectionable. Then one night, I decided to put one of these CDs in. The Spirit, I like to say that the Spirit moved me to take the CD, put it in, and this guy, Mark Houston, opens up a talk. I'll never forget. He goes, I love meetings that start with meditation. And I'm like, what is this dude talking about? And he starts talking about the 10th step in a way I'd never been introduced to. It just made sense to me, and I went back to the book, and then this other guy, Chris Raymer, he talked about the spiritual malady. And then he talked about what I was experiencing, and everything changed for me. And then I meet people like Mike and Carl and Scott, and everything changed for me at that point, because they'd already been introduced to this way of doing things. It's no different than it's still the big book. It's just maybe looking at different questions as you walk through the book. So Nari played, I mean, this man, I can't tell you the place he holds in my heart, because if God hadn't used him that night walking out of that meeting for him to hand me those CDs, and for whatever reason, I didn't throw them in the trash. I just kept them in my car door until I was until it was time. So I always got to tell that story, man. And surrender. We're going to show you guys in the next, after these two sessions, I'm hoping you'll have a better idea of how to take someone through a first step and how to look at your own first step. But there's a part of the first step you cannot work. I don't care how much time you spend with your sponsor. It's called surrender. If we could all work surrender, we would have done it before all the things happened to us. Okay, before the bankruptcy, before the kids are gone, before I'm having to deal with the defects, before I'm having to deal with attorneys, before my family cuts me off, before I do the things that no man ever wants to admit that he did. All these things that happen to us as a result of our addictions, if I could create surrender, when I first felt the nip of the ringer, I would have surrendered. But I got pretty badly mangled in the ringer. And the book says it, that most of us have to be pretty badly mangled before we commence to solve our problems. But surrender, I think, is given to us. It's a gift. My surrender occurred, you know, I woke up on the morning of October 29th, 2007. I was arrested on the evening of November 4th, 2007, and I didn't sleep. I slept for an 8-hour period in 5 days. And I was incarcerated for the next 5 weeks, and in that incarceration, I had several things happen. So when you have surrender, the voice that's sitting, there's a voice that's speaking to you right this second as I'm talking. Your voice is speaking to you, and it's either telling you I'm full of shit, I don't have to do what this guy does, or it's going to say this guy is speaking the truth. Okay? It's a spirit, it's a witness, it's a watcher, but there's also an aspect of dishonesty to it, which I call the liar. It's lying to you. Its sole purpose is to say, I'm different, or let's talk you out of what's in your highest good. And what happens with surrender is the voice of the liar goes into remission. It's not killed off because it's coming back. It goes into remission, and we call it the pink cloud or the window of grace in the rooms. And everybody's pink cloud or window of grace is last, I think, is a different amount of time. And here's where your life hangs in the balance. The amount of time it takes for the voice to return and start lying to you and you start to buy what it's saying is how long you've got to work the steps. You need to work the steps, in my opinion, before the liar reasserts itself on the scene. And that cannot be created by us. We can't claim that. That is what surrender is. And for me, I was in a courtroom. I was shackled at my knees. I was shackled at my wrists. Hadn't seen my mom in a long time. Nobody wanted me. And my brother, best friend, and my parents didn't want anything to do with me. So I experienced this sense of being more alone than I've ever experienced. Couldn't see my life with whiskey or crack cocaine. And I couldn't see my life without whiskey or crack cocaine. So I literally had reached that jumping off place. I'd been terrible at living and I'd been terrible at dying. I couldn't do either one right. And I got to this place, and I'm in this courtroom, and I heard a guy named Peter describe it one year at the monastery. He said I was split wide open, and I had all these flashbacks as he was saying split wide open, and I had this recollection of thoughts of me in this courtroom, the light between me. Like I turned to my attorney, I said, "Have you talked to my mom?" And I turned around, and my mom was there, and I hadn't seen her in a long time, and she was this pale, frail woman that almost collapsed in the courtroom. And all I could think was, like, I did that to her. And I am willing to do whatever I have to do, never to do that to another person. But everything inside of me knew I was going to smoke crack again. And everything inside of me didn't want to smoke crack ever again. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I had finally reached a place where I had no plan. No plan. I love guys in early recovery that have a goddamn plan. Because they're the ones that are going to fail. When you don't have a plan is when this works really well. And that surrender looks like open-mindedness. And you follow instructions. And you don't question anything. And there's very little defiance. And that is an experience I cannot claim, nor did I create. It was given to me. And if you're questioning whether or not you have it, you better go into some serious, sincere prayer life asking for it. I mean, I think we'd all surrender if we could do it on our own. So that's my surrender.
All right. So let's jump into the stories and the more about alcoholism. Guys, having the big book, you could follow along. We want to start with the man of 30 story, which is the second full paragraph on page 32. All right, guys, ready? So in this story, we don't see the spiritual malady, but we will see this peculiar mental twist, and we will see the progression of the disease. And when we read the story, read along, I'm going to point where exactly the peculiar mental twist happened. All right, let's start. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor, like me. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would go nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control after whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Here is the mental twist. Then he fell victim to the belief which practically every alcoholic has. That is, long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In two months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problems, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and he was dead within 4 years. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we had remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here was a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. So you hear all this what do you call cliches in the program, like this is a freaking one day at a time program. It's not. It's a commitment you got to make. You got to realize you are powerless, and you got to make a commitment no matter what. No matter what, no spouse, no job, whatever, no house. And somewhere in the working of the steps, it talks about like once you surrender and you take that position, right, God is going to direct you. You're going to be given everything you need as long as you do the work. And that work is helping other alcoholics, drug addicts. That's it, period. That's the only aim of a recovered alcoholic.
Correct. Denari just said a very important word, commitment. I used to say that people only relapse for one reason, that you're not in fit spiritual condition. That's it. Now I'm starting to add a subsection to that reason, which is you've lost your commitment. And what do I mean by that? I've watched it over the years. I've been doing this long enough to watch people who are... I just watched a guy for 15 months be committed, more committed than most I've ever seen in 10 years. And the commitment made him look like a pep rally for the 12 steps and a pep rally for God. And then about 5 months ago, commitment became the girl. And then commitment turned to making money. And then commitment turned to Vyvanse. And then commitment turned to Xanax. And then commitment turned to alcohol. And then commitment turned to cocaine. And then commitment turned to heroin. And then he OD'd. Fortunately, he's not dead. It all goes back to commitment. What are you committed to? What is, you know, the book calls it, what is the central fact of your life? Is it recovery in these 12 steps and deepening your experience with God? Because if it's that, then I promise you, you'll have permanent recovery in your life. But if you're committed to other things, like getting your kids back, or the money, or the job, or the boyfriend, or the girlfriend, you will fail. I promise you. I don't know the time period it's going to take, but it'll happen. If you fit the description of the alcoholic and the addict in the book, that's my disclaimer to everything. I'm only really talking to people who fit the description of the alcoholic and the addict that's in the big book. That's who I'm talking to. You know, as our buddy says, if you're a disco drunk or some like recreational drug user to just happen to find yourself in here, I ain't talking to you. Okay? That's not who I'm here to help. I will sometimes help those people, but my core purpose here is to help the hopeless, the one of the hopeless variety. That's who I really like to help. You need to ask, this is a wonderful question to take into your meditation. What am I committed to? You know, I don't know what you guys do for meditation, but you can ponder or contemplate something like that. What am I worshiping today? Is it truly a power greater than myself and how I can cultivate and nurture that relationship? Or am I worshiping other things? This is what commitment looks like to me. In terms of this story that we just went over in the book, and there were years in my, you know, I struggled with addiction, I'd say for the better part of 7 to 8 years, where I knew there was something off. And I wasn't happy with the results in my life, but I had periods of sobriety in that 7 to 8 years that I thought qualified me to be a recreational drug user. Burn it all to the ground, make a firm resolution, I'm not smoking crack anymore, I'm not going to drink anymore, because every time I drink, I end up in a crack house or a crack hotel, and I don't want to do that anymore, so I'm not drinking anymore. And so I go for 4, 5, 6, 2 weeks, and I'm like, holy shit, I got this under control now, right? Next thing you know, I'm at a bar or at a friend's house. I'm drinking. There's some Xanax. There's some key bumps. And somebody, you know, you got 8 people and they got a half ounce of cocaine. I don't want to fuck with that. You know, oh, that's not enough for me. Right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to dip out of the party real quick, get in my car and go downtown because I've already woken up the monster. And that I always had this idea that a prolonged period of what I called sobriety, because, you know, smoking pot is just you're still sober, right? Wrong. So... But back then, it was right, right? If I was popping Valium and smoking pot, I was sober, right? That was sobriety. And periods of prolonged sobriety away from Oxycontin, heroin, and cocaine, I was like, yeah, I got this now, right? The Jax Teller syndrome. You guys watch Sons of Anarchy? Every time Jax said, I got this, he fucked everything up. And that was me. I got this now. And what happened? I fucked everything up. There I go, cussing up a storm, man.
We're in a church.
I know, I ain't wearing a church.
There was cussing during the funeral, so.
Oh, yeah. you go, Nari.
Alrighty. So, we're going to look at that car salesman story, which I love because he's the copybook of a true alcoholic, and I could relate to it. And you could see all three elements of the disease we've been talking about the whole day. And it starts on page 35. And before we go into the story, there is that paragraph I want to go through where it says, like, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment again of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, or mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he, or what is he thinking? This is like, we've seen this often, you know, almost every day these days, like, you know, somebody walking out of a treatment center, going directly and picking up a six pack, or going, coming out of a jail, picking up a, you know, going to a drug joint. So they're trying to say, what's going on in the freaking mind of the alcoholic drug addict? So they throw in this example. So our first example is a friend who we shall call him Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable world war record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent and intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. So if you look at this guy, right, he had everything. He has a charming wife. It's not even an ugly wife. It's a charming wife. And he inherited a lucrative automobile agency, right? And he had a commendable world war record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. But he has a nervous disposition. He needs to have this boost, right? So we told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had a deep affection. Yet, he got drunk again. We asked him to tell exactly what had happened. This is his story. So he's narrating what happened, right? So I just wanted to kind of give you some ideas. Like, so he had lost the business he once owned. So there is that resentment, right? He hasn't solved that yet. So he's going into this office Tuesday morning, obviously. He missed work on Monday. And the boss is asking, what the heck were you on Monday, right? So he's pissed that he has to answer to the boss. So I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. So this is the key. He had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had a notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Again, still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Here comes the peculiar mental twist in italics. Anything in italics in Big Book, you want to watch carefully, right? So suddenly, the thought comes across my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on full stomach. So here comes the physical craving. After he puts the first drink, the experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me so much. I tried another. So this is the third drink in rapid succession. But what triggered was that sudden peculiar thought that he could handle whiskey, you know, in a full stomach. This story, you know, you could see all the three elements of the disease, like the spiritual malady and the mental twist and the physical craving. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. You remember Bill's story, you know, he went through 5 years of that torture. He had no job. He the story says like he hardly drew a sober breath. You see what I'm saying? Like, so you go through that cycle and you are caught in that vicious cycle of alcoholism. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it in milk. So what is the issue with this guy? He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. That means he didn't work the remainder of the 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening. And you know, then you get to experience all the, you know, promises of the 12 steps. And Tarek pointed to that 10-step proposition where you'll be placed in a position of neutrality. Like in my 11 years, I will be completing my 11 years, 27th of September. So I have had one time that thought come through that, like, you know what, my father was dead. He was there, and the funeral was about to take place, and the thought came through, and it was immediately replaced that you're a freaking alcoholic. You know, you're there for the family. That's spiritual awakening. That's the power of this program. You don't, you know, a flame. You know, you don't flare up the flame. You just shut it immediately. And I've never been, you know, by the grace of God, the obsession has not come back to me. And I'm so, so grateful for this program.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ryan. So the in this chapter specifically, I think they're trying to show us and illustrate to us the different states of mind that precede a relapse. And I think they're also trying to show us there's no real external trigger. It's an internal. It's either false ideas, which is what the exceptional man, he's the guy that was 35 and decided he'd been doing some spree drinking, but he made up his mind and just stopped. And he thought a prolonged period of sobriety had qualified him to drink like other people, and the physical aspect of his illness picked up right where it left off 25 years before. And I think if you looked at your experience, you would all find that there have been prolonged periods of sobriety or clean time that you believe qualified you to now be a recreational drug user or a social drinker. Maybe I'm wrong, but look into your experience. Then you have Mr. Jim. Now, I'm going to tell you, I love telling stories, and I think it gets my point across. So the story I'm about to tell you is just, it's an example of several stories that played out in my life. I can't remember what year this was. It was 2006 or 2007. But I was one of the groomsmen in a wedding, and I'd been put in charge of getting all the cocaine for this reception. And so I got some ounces of cocaine, and there was this concert, a local concert going on in town. And, you know, we figured, you know, I could this ounce, 28 grams, we sell this one, and then we end up with all this free cocaine for the reception. And all went well. You know, I hung out with my friends all night, and, you know, we drank. We didn't rage at the concert, and I'm dirty. I take a cab back to my house, and I get back to my house. It's like between 6 or 7 in the morning, and suddenly the thought crosses my mind that I can cook 1 gram of cocaine. And so I cooked that 1 gram of cocaine. And then I sat in my bathroom in my bedroom until that was like 6 or 7 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon the next day. I had smoked a half ounce of coke by myself. I'm barricaded in the bathroom. My girlfriend at the time comes over. I will not let her in the bathroom. I've got the door closed like this with my crack stem, and she can go out on the back deck and look into the bathroom. Right? So she looks into the bathroom, and here I am with porno mags laid out on the floor in my fucking boxers with a crack stem, and I'm barricaded the door. And I won't let her in, and she's flipping out, right? So she leaves. And she goes to this wedding reception where some people knew I was bad off on crack. I had a lot of old friends there that had no idea how bad off on crack I was. And my phone just started blowing up with, "You're a piece of shit. I can't believe you did this. We never want to talk to you again." And I just packed my shit and took all the cocaine. I left them a pile of money for all the cocaine I did. And I went and got a hotel. And I stayed in that hotel for a few days. And I had so much guilt and shame around that for so long. But it's like what the big book says. You know, how can the inability to think and lack of proportion be anything else but insanity? And that's what I exhibited that day. I couldn't think straight around that first one. And I definitely lacked proportion once I started. But here's the part of this is the reason I tell this story. In the doctor's opinion, it says we hope that the physical craving can explain things you cannot otherwise account for. Until I understood what the physical craving really meant, I couldn't account for why I did that. So I carried a great deal of guilt and shame. And when a man taught me the physical craving and told me, you know, once you smoked that first gram that morning, you weren't really responsible for the rest of the stuff you did after that. You're responsible because you have to go make amends. You're responsible because you can't tell them you did that because of a physical craving. Nobody you make amends to wants to hear that shit. I woke up the monster inside, and once the monster wakes up, the monster goes to sleep when the monster wants to go to sleep, and that's why I did what I did. Nobody wants to hear that. What they want to hear is I regret what I did, and I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to make it right. That's all they want to hear. But I tell you that story because I will guarantee you, you guys have done some stuff that's creating a great deal of guilt and shame inside of you because you think or you believe you could have done different. And if you do have a physical craving, you couldn't have done any different. Every single person in here right now is craving something. It's called air. And you would not realize you're craving it until I walked up behind you and put a bag over your head. Then you'd fight for it, right? You would fight and you would claw and you would scratch. What do you think happens when people try to cut off our physical craving? We fight, we claw, we scratch, we steal, we pawn, we rob. That's why the physical craving and understanding it in that way is helpful to an addict or alcoholic, because all they, you know, we have guilt and shame. It has the power to kill. But people that have guilt and shame, I don't truly think they understand their first step. Not based out of experience. Because true powerlessness means you don't have power. You could not have done any different. So get free. But don't say that when you go make amends. Okay? Don't say this redhead guy at this workshop said this on Saturday, and I want to explain to you why I've broke into your house and robbed all your shit. That's not what I'm saying here, but I want you to get free of the guilt and shame, because the rooms run rampant with people that have it, I think because they don't have a good understanding of the first step. So.
All right, we'll jump into the third story. So I just give a brief idea of the jaywalker. I don't want to disappoint you guys. So there is the jaywalker story, the guy who skips traffic and gets hit by the oncoming traffic. And the book says, like, you would think that it's an insane thing, right? And that's what they kind of put that story, and kind of they want to show that we are doing the same thing with our alcoholism. And so we'll start with page 38. It says, like, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we have substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. How intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol have been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Some of you are thinking. So they're talking about Fred and some of us. Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such thing cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. That's what most of the people come out of the treatment center, tell us. Like they think that once the alcohol has been separated, they think they are good. Whatever you guys told us, it's not going to work. We're going to handle it on our own way. This is what is going on with this guy, Fred, okay? So again, before jumping into this story, there is that key paragraph. There is some, ideas that the big book wants to convey. That may be true for certain alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. So that's the key difference between the hard drinker and the real alcoholic. You got to make a decision. You got to come to a realization. Am I a hard drinker or a real alcoholic? And this is what they're saying. But the actual or a potential alcoholic, with hardly any exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is the point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize. You see the wordings of the big book, the authors, how they kind of drive home the fact that, like we already saw that in Bill's story. Bill's story, Dr. Silkworth gave him the idea of powerlessness. And he said, this is it. Self-knowledge is going to fix it. And it didn't. He drank like, you know, like a ski jump. And then what happened was fear sobered him a bit. And it didn't. And he again drank. And here again, they're talking about the self-knowledge is not going to, you know, fix him. Okay, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers, as it has been a reveal to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. So, here is Fred. Fred is partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He was a he has a fine home. He's happily married again. You see that? This guy is similar to the Jeff the car salesman, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone like that, just like that. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet, like the car salesman, he is an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in the hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself as an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his solution, for his problem, I'm sorry. So, this guy doesn't want to admit that he's an alcoholic. So, you cannot propose the solution. If you are not accepting the powerlessness, there is no point in, you know, going forward. Okay, so that's why we spend a lot of time in, you know, trying to relay this, you know, the traits of alcoholism. So, where were we? So, yeah. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. He was interested and considered that he had some symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of the life. Self-knowledge would fix it. See, this is like, you know, you think through the drink, you know, you hear this in meetings, you cannot, it will not work. You will not think through the drink. You will, all your focusing is on that effect produced by alcohol. Okay, so here, as the story goes on, we heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellas said about alcoholism. And I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. Here again, you know, he's talking about, oh yeah, you guys told me about the subtle, you know, insanity that precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I have learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows that had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident that it would only matter of exercising my willpower. There again, he is depending on this willpower and keeping on God. So in this frame of mind, I went about my business. For a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. So here is where he is getting cocky, you know. Man, these guys are, you know, bullshit. I should be able to, like, you know. stay away from alcohol without this hard work. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about it. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. So here comes the peculiar mental twist. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to my mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. So here comes the craving part. And you would ask, like, where is the spiritual malady in this guy? But it's kind of subtle. I could say he was like kind of excited state. For an alcoholic, even excitement is not good. That's why, you know, in the working of the 11th step, it talks about like on being on an even keel. You want to be in the middle. You don't want to have like too much excitement or too much remorse or guilt. You want to be like right in the center. Okay. So this dude is happy, you know, and not a cloud on the horizon. But then that insane idea comes through, the peculiar mental twist. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to my mind, it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered another cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine. So now it's gone case, okay? So I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. So he's like, so the wife comes to know about it. So he's on that spree and she said, screw you, you know, you are on your own. So this guy is like on a cab, you know, the whole, you know, several days it says, like he was on a bender. I know little of where I went or what I said. Just like Derek was talking about, you know, once he took that and then he was like, you know, you act crazy. So he was on that bender. Then came the physical hospital and unbearable mental and physical suffering. So here is the key. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went through carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only I had been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. So this is the blind spot we're talking about the whole afternoon. This time I had not thought of any consequences at all. So the dude at the living, you know, sober living, he was talking about it. So I planned my drinking, right? Like, but then did you plan your consequences? No, nobody wants to get like, you know, being in a prison. Nobody wants to get a DUI, right? But it clouds us. And he says, like, I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I had raised the defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew for that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help the strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had been hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. So that's the power, you know, the mental powerlessness of step one. And you could see the connection between the unmanageability and the powerlessness. And the physical craving, like Tarek pointed out, is important. But we got to go step back and see what is the main problem of the alcoholic. It's that like insane idea that goes between our ears. So Tarek.
Thanks, Ari. So, you know, the first guy, for long periods of sobriety, qualifies you to drink. No. Second guy has a resentment. He works for a company he used to own. He's a little more progressed. You know, he's actually lost a lot of things as a result of his drinking. He works a few steps, makes a beginning, but fails to perfect in a larger spiritual life. Then you got Fred, who to me is like a high bottom guy. You know, he hasn't had a lot of consequences. He does try the self-knowledge route, and it's the end of a perfect day. So he's got no resentment, no really screwed up internal condition, but then he gets the peculiar mental twist shows up, and he drinks. And then you've got the jaywalker, who I think most of us really identify with. I mean, if you've reached the point where you're shooting dope or you're smoking crack, chances are you've experienced the jaywalker. Okay? Now, with alcohol, it takes a little bit longer, but you can experience it with alcohol too. And so they've given you a spectrum of what we're dealing here with addiction and alcoholism. But, I mean, it all, you know, page 44 sums it all up. You know, if when drinking you have little control, or if when using drugs you have little control over the amount you do, and if you cannot stay stopped entirely on your own, you always seem to go back to the first one, no matter how great the necessity or the wish not to do so, then you're probably an addict and you're probably an alcoholic, and you just might be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And there's a trap door in the word only. Here's another question I'll leave you with. Do you think a vital spiritual experience is your only solution? And so I'm going to tell a story, and then we're going to stop and take a break. If you, you know, if you took 100 people out of the rooms of AA and CA and you put them back in the bar or the party scene, you're going to find something if you really pay attention. A third of those people are going to go into a bar. They're going to go into the bar. They're going to have a little half gram, a gram of cocaine in their pocket. And they're going to drink and do enough key bumps just to feel good. And they're going to go home. Then you got this other third that's going to go to the bar. And they're going to belly up to the bar. And they're going to wallow in their whiskey drink. And they're going to cry in their little bag of cocaine. And they're going to tell you that's all there is of alcohol and drugs. And then you got this other third who's going to burn that bar to the ground. And then they're going to burn the next bar to the ground. And then they're going to burn the house party to the ground. And then they're going to end up on Boulevard and North Avenue. If you take those people out of the rooms and out of the bars and the party scene and put them back in the rooms of AA and CA, that's exactly how they work the steps. You got a third of people that go to the rooms and they use the rooms and the meetings like a spiritual filling station, and they suck everything they can out of the rooms of AA and CA because they need to get to their meeting, and they go home. And then you got this other third that uses our meetings like group therapy. And they want an answer to their specific chicken shit little problem when they go to a meeting. And they cry in our meetings and they wallow in their big books and they tell you this is all there is of this 12-step process. And then you got my tribe. My tribe is the mad dogs. And they go in the meetings, spearheads for God's ever-advancing creation. And they clear the way for other people by telling the truth. The truth is, if you're suffering from this illness, you must have a spiritual experience in your life. That's it. That's all we have to offer here. Nothing more, nothing less. So, thanks for listening to us. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and then Carl's going to give a talk.